Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Judge James Gray. He's a retired court judge and former federal prosecutor in California, and he was a criminal defense attorney in the Navy with the JAG Corps, and he's the author of several books, including Why Our Drug Laws Have Failed, a judicial indictment of the war on drugs. He will be speaking this coming Thursday, the 30th of September, from 6 to 7 at UNM Law School in room 2402. And he will be speaking here in Santa Fe on Friday, the 1st of October, from 5 to 6 at the Old Para Building in Apodaca Hall. His lecture is titled Passing Judgment on the Drug War. Welcome, Judge Gray, to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you, Mary, and I'm certainly looking forward to sharing some thoughts with good people in New Mexico this coming Thursday and Friday.
So the title of your book makes it clear that you consider the war on drugs a great failure. Tell us about how, in your career as an attorney and a judge, how this became clear to you.
Well, as a prosecutor, as a judge at the beginning, I considered myself to be a drug warrior, so-called. And I held the record for the largest drug prosecution in the Central District of California back in 1978. 75 kilos of heroin, 160 pounds was and is a lot of heroin. Looking back now, you see that the major prosecution is 18 tons of cocaine in one place. So obviously that's we're going backwards. And I look in my own courtroom and see that we're churning low-level drug offenders through the system for no good purpose. In many ways, we're ruining people's lives and that of their family members. We're labeling them as automatic criminals and felons and making them unemployable. And they still get out of jail or prison with the same drug problems that they had when they went into it. So you just start looking at what we're doing. And also, you see where we sometimes arrest and convict and incarcerate even heavy-time dealers. Does that mean that cocaine or marijuana is no longer available in such and such a city? And of course the answer is no. Other people just see it as an employment opportunity. So you start focusing on what we're doing and you start making distinctions. And one distinction is that there's a major difference to be made between drug harms, and I'm not minimizing them. These drugs can be dangerous, can be addicting, just like my drug of choice, which happens to be alcohol. But the other problem is drug money harms, and they are far worse than the drug harms themselves. Just like with regard basically to alcohol prohibition, the drug money harms with the Al Capones and the corruption and the violence and all that goes with it, disrespect for law, that's not caused by alcohol. This is not caused by other drugs. It's caused by drug money. And so we start dealing with it in a much more managerial fashion. That is, let's stop moralizing about these various drugs and start managing them, and then you start making a lot of progress.
As a judge, you and many other judges that we talk about had to uphold laws that at a certain point you didn't think were right. Give us some examples, some stories of what this actually looks like.
Well, of course. And of course, it is my obligation to follow the law, and if I don't, I should resign. Nevertheless, I don't have to do it quietly, and that's how I was able to hold a press conference back in 1992 as a sitting judge, saying there had to be a better way. So one way is, for example, today in California, under California law, it is a violation for anyone to have a hypodermic needle and syringe, and unless you have a prescription for it from a medical doctor, and it's prohibited for a medical doctor to prescribe a hypodermic needle and syringe to somebody, for example, that's using illicit drugs. So you look at this and see that all of the studies show that needle exchange programs, which are basically simple, they exchange a dirty needle for a clean one, no money changes hands, no questions are asked, and they are being used around the nation today, fortunately. But needle exchange programs do not increase drug usage. They don't decrease it either. They pretty much are neutral in that regard, but they do decrease the incidence of AIDS and hepatitis and other bloodborne diseases by about 50%. And you just can't help but conclude that it's a crime to keep people that happen to be using illegal injecting drugs from getting a clean needle because you're just exacerbating the problem. And you talk to heroin-addicted people, which I do with some frequency, and they will tell you, you know, it's easier for me to get my heroin than it is to get a clean needle, which is downright stupid. Another thing, gosh, in juvenile court, I was on the abused and neglected children calendar, and I would have this fact pattern happen maybe every 3 or 4 weeks, or you'd have a single mother of two, for example, make a bad decision, and she'd hook up with the wrong boyfriend who happened to be selling drugs. And one fine day, he would tell her, well, tell you what, Helen, if you take this package across town and give it to Charlie, I'll pay you $500 or something. And she'd basically know it contained narcotics, but, you know, gee, $500 will help me with half my month's rent. I need the money, etc. So she'd do it. Okay, so she gets arrested, convicted, and sentenced to 5 years in prison, which honestly in today's system for transporting 3 or 4 ounces of heroin or cocaine is not an unreasonable sentence. So you ask yourself, when the mother is now incarcerated, what happens to her children? And the answer to that is easily. She has legally abandoned her children, which means that they come to me in the juvenile court on the abused and neglected children calendar. And I would look at the mother, who's now in handcuffs in a jail jumpsuit, and tell her the truth, which is, you know, ma'am, you're not functionally going to be a part of your children's lives for the next 5 years. She starts to well up with tears. I mean, wouldn't you? And then you tell her the brutal truth, which is, you understand that unless you are really lucky and either have a close personal friend or family member that's both willing and able to take care of your children, they're going to be adopted by somebody else by the time you get out of prison. And she dissolves in tears. And unfortunately, a lot of people where I come from in Orange County don't get too caught up with the human issues, but I can get them dissolving in tears as well, because as taxpayers, it's going to cost about $5,000 per month per child to keep them in a group home until they're adopted. So that's about $60,000 per child times, say, 2 children from the mother. That's $120,000, plus another $25,000 physically to separate a mother from her children when she's in jail. That's $145,000 of taxpayer money that we're spending. And it's just absurd. It just isn't working. And, you know, the boyfriend, he, you know, he has some information so he can, in effect, turn evidence against the higher-ups. The woman has nothing. So she ends up serving a longer prison sentence even than the boyfriend who was selling the drugs. The whole thing simply is unworkable, unfair, and very expensive.
And when you think about the lives of these children, they have a great setback in life because they're more likely to do badly in school because of the disruption in their lives and not go on to have a stable future.
Oh, Mary, that's so true. And in fact, the studies show that children are more likely to follow in the footsteps of their parents. If one is arrested and incarcerated, the odds are much better that the children will end up in jail or prison as well. It's just a self-inflicted wound that is truly unnecessary in so many ways.
The reality is, and you make this very clear in your work, that drugs are not going anywhere. Moralize as we may, be against them as some of us may, there's a lot of demand for drugs in this country, and in your home state of California, marijuana is a bigger crop than food.
You're right. Marijuana today is the largest cash crop in the state of California. And as I tell people frequently, number two is grapes, by the way, if you care. And you can go to Napa Valley or San Luis Obispo and see these miles and miles of vineyards. Just understand that marijuana is a larger cash crop than that. And obviously, then, somebody is buying it. Somebody is using it. And so it's now pretty much illegal as you can make it, although it's still only a citation now to possess under an ounce. But it's a felony to sell marijuana, and you can get in prison for 10, 20, 30 years, whatever. And even so, you will never, ever run out of people willing to take even large criminal justice risks to sell small amounts of drugs for large amounts of money. And so if you arrest somebody for doing it, someone else simply sees that as an employment opportunity and takes his or her place. Plus, Mary, and this is something people need to look at, if I am a drug dealer, how much risk-taking can I buy for $50 in cash, for example, from a 15, 16-year-old boy or girl in the inner city or anywhere else? And the answer is quite a bit. You know, $50 is nothing to an adult drug dealer, but it's a lot of money to a 15, 16-year-old. So for chump change, in effect, I can recruit all of the young people I want, and I'll use them as gophers or lookouts or couriers or whatever. And then, and I'd see this in juvenile court as well, as soon as their reliability is established, I will trust them to go out and sell small amounts of drugs in their communities. Why would I do such a scurrilous thing? And, of course, the answer to that is easy. I make more money. The kids make more money. Then ask yourself this question. If you have a 15, 16-year-old boy or girl selling drugs in his or her community. Who are these kids going to sell to, Mary? People like you and me? Nonsense. They're going to sell to their 14, 15, 16-year-old peers, thus recruiting more children to that very lifestyle that we're trying so hard to keep away from them, and it is directly caused by our policy of drug prohibition. You do not have children selling Jim Beam bourbon to each other on a high school campus or Winston cigarettes or otherwise, because those are controlled and regulated by the government. And it's the illegal drugs where we have abandoned all controls. That's what's corrupting our children, and shame on us.
Why is it that we here in the U.S. are such big consumers of drugs?
You know, I have my opinions on that. And I guess since I'm your guest, you want my opinion.
I do.
We have a harder line drug policy of drug prohibition in the United States of America than any other Western industrialized country. And we also have a bigger drug problem than any Western industrialized country. I'm convinced that there's a parallel there. And if you look at a country like Portugal, and I'm surprised that the media has not passed this information out more. In the year 2000, 10 years ago, the leaders of Portugal looked around and saw that they had bigger drug problems in their country than any other industrialized country in the Western European Union. And so they did something smart, and they impaneled a non-political group of experts to look into the situation and make recommendations. And what those people found is they came back with two conclusions. And the first was, you know, people with drug problems are afraid of their own government. Why? Obviously, if they bring their problems to the government will punish them, so they take their problems underground. And the second conclusion was the government is spending so much money in the investigation, prosecution, and incarceration of nonviolent drug offenders, the government doesn't have any money left for drug treatment. So in the year 2001, Portugal decriminalized all drugs. And Cato Institute looked at all of the information, the facts, the evidence, up until the year 2007, and then they published a report in 2009. And what they said is that basically the usage of drugs in Portugal remained the same. So all of these people that are saying, oh, we'd become a nation of drug zombies and stuff like that, it didn't happen. And in fact, if anything, the usage of drugs went down about half a percentage point. But the problem drug usage in Portugal decreased by half, by a full 50%. Why? Because that non-political panel was right. Now people are coming to the government with their problems. Instead of getting arrested, they're seeing medical community people that are helping them, and they are starting to come into a reality and getting some help with regard to their drug abuse. Plus, and all importantly, a lot of children now in Portugal are not going down this road. They're not beginning that program of drug use. Why? Well, heaven's sake, there's no fun in that. Why should I start using drugs and then go see a doctor? That's not interesting. There's no glamour there. So fewer children are starting to go down that path. And Portugal is doing really well, and we should learn from that example. We should, in fact, because I have heard this all the time. Oh, you know, if we were to pass Proposition 19 here in California, which we'll probably talk about, and it's going to be on the ballot this coming November 2nd to treat marijuana like alcohol. Oh, people are saying that now everybody is going to start using marijuana, and they're going to use smoking marijuana while they're driving a car and all of this other silly stuff, and it's just not true. And you could give away marijuana or cocaine, for that matter, for free on every street corner in town and bless it by every religious leader within shouting distance, and I'm still not going to jam cocaine up my nose. And Mary, you're probably not either, and although I don't know you, I would go so far as to say you or anybody else, if you're going to, you're probably doing it already. So let's stop kidding ourselves. Let's start managing these problems, and let's start realizing that, yes, there are drug problems, but how about drug purity problems, too? You know, with alcohol prohibition, we had a huge problem with what we called bathtub gin, that is, impurities in the distilled spirits. And you couldn't find out about it, really, until some of your customers start keeling over, it attacks your nervous system, and they'd be in a coma, or some would die, etc. Those are problems that went away when we came to our senses and repealed alcohol prohibition. And I myself sentenced a young man for being under the influence of methamphetamines, and he told me at time of sentencing, and he's entitled to make a statement, Your Honor, my drug of choice is marijuana, and I have bought my marijuana from the same supplier now for several years. And one fine day, he sold me some marijuana that, without my knowing it, was laced with methamphetamines. I smoked it a few times, and I got myself hooked. Now, that is a problem that we can deal with. The government can ensure the quality, etc. That's a problem that today we have in spades, because if you buy, and I shudder to say it, methamphetamines or anything else, you have no idea what is in that stuff. You have no idea what the quality or the strength is. Those are issues that we can use, and we can reduce the harms that can and will be caused by the presence of these drugs in our communities, and including, of course, the drug money harms, which we can also take the money away from juvenile gangs, away from the Mexican drug cartels, away from a lot of these other thugs, and yes, we can tax it and put that money into the cities, counties, and states to use for a benefit. I'm not saying we should legalize drugs for that reason, but it's a nice side benefit along the way. So for all of these reasons, we start managing the problem instead of moralizing about it, we will stop harming ourselves nearly as much as we are doing now.
We're talking to Judge James Gray. One of the things that I think is really important to understand is that drug selling is a capitalist enterprise just like any other, only the distribution channels and salespeople are different, as you were alluding to. How does it actually work? Let's say an illegal drug like marijuana is grown, well, of course it's grown in California, but it's grown in Mexico. What does the enterprise look like that brings it from Mexico to the end user in the United States?
Well, these folks are very creative. When I was in the U.S. Attorney's Office as a federal prosecutor, they're always about 2.5 steps ahead of the government. There was one prosecution we had where there were people in Mexico that were actually taking cocaine and adding that to fiberglass and actually making dog cages. And then they would send the dog cages, of course, with the dog in it, into the United States. Once that happened, they'd melt it down, get rid of the fiberglass, and there was the cocaine. I mean, there's really creative stuff. You'd put them in cans of peaches. There's all kinds of ways to bringing them in here. Why? Because there's such an enormous amount of money to do it. And you ask any undercover police officer, or any police officer, and anyone that's candid will tell you the truth, which is they might say that we seize 10% of the illegal drugs in our society, and that's really an exaggeration, because the more candid ones will tell you the truth. We seize about 5%. So for every ton of cocaine, for example, that we seize with great fanfare and photo opportunities and the rest, that's not a victory. It's just a symptom of the depth of the problem, because for every ton we seize, we fail to seize somewhere between 10 and 15 tons. So you begin to understand it's the money that is driving this bus. And the head of the DEA was quoted one time as saying that at any one time, Mary, there are 200 tons of cocaine in Mexico being warehoused within 3 miles of the U.S. border, simply waiting for there to be a scarcity in Albuquerque or Dubuque or Miami or wherever to smuggle the drugs in here from there. So, we couldn't use more drugs in here if we tried. They're there, they're present, and it's the money that's going to continue to supply that demand. And you can come down to it, and I say this frequently, and it's true. We could bulldoze the entire country of Colombia, for example. And in fact, we could take Ecuador and Peru with it if we wanted to. And it wouldn't make any difference at all with regard to our problems here with drugs. Why? Because if the demand is here, the demand will be met. And if you have somebody standing on a street corner with a $20 bill in his hand, somebody will supply $20 worth of drugs to him. And if it's not done by Colombia, Ecuador, or Peru, it'll be done by people in Nigeria or Thailand or Burma, or, of course, California, which is the largest cash crop, is still marijuana. And the Hell's Angels, of course, are doing really well and selling lots of methamphetamine. Somebody will supply it. And so we just have to realize that there's never been a society in the history of mankind that has not had some form of mind-altering, sometimes addicting drug to use, misuse, abuse, or even get addicted to, except maybe the Eskimos, because they couldn't grow anything. But now, of course, chemistry and transportation has changed that as well. So I'm sorry it's here, but it is. And there's nothing we can do about it. Let's try to manage these problems instead of moralize about them, and we'll do so much better.
Once the drugs come out of Mexico and get into distribution channels in the United States, as you write about in your books, there are a lot of young people teenagers, school kids, and so on, who end up being the essentially workers in this enterprise, in this capitalist enterprise.
Of course. Of course. You know, honestly, it's kind of the Horatio Alger story of today's world, that, look, you come up to somebody and say, you really want to make some money? We might as well take out billboards and make this announcement, because this is the message that our children are receiving. Yes, you know, there are only so many Michael Jordans in this world, or yes, you can become a medical doctor or an engineer, but if you're not going to get those things, you can make more money by selling drugs than you can in anything else you would do. And in fact, it's corrupting our children. You can just visualize a party with teenagers going on a Friday night, and somebody that sells drugs goes up to some acquaintance and says, well, you're working for a living, aren't you? Yeah, well, what are you doing? Oh, I'm working in a car wash, I'm working at McDonald's, whatever it happens to be. Oh, really? How much money did you make last week? Well, I made $150. You know, I can make five times that much in an afternoon selling drugs, and he's right, and of course, everybody knows it. It's corrupting our children. It's corrupting, of course, adults as well. It's corrupting society. And you go beyond that, you see, you know who Charles Manson is.
Mm-hmm.
Charles Manson was moved from Corcoran State Prison in California to a different penal institution several years ago now because he was found to be selling illegal drugs from his prison cell, and he was in solitary confinement. So I tell folks that, you know, if we can't keep drugs out of prison, and we can't, what makes them you think that we can keep them off the streets of Santa Fe or Las Vegas or any other place in this world? We can't. And it's corrupting prison guards. I mean, they come in, they smuggle it in that way, or a lot of other people bring it in, or they'll throw it over the walls. Whatever, the drugs are here. So just trying to say, I wish it weren't happening, is not a plan. It's just not a program. And today, just trying to put everybody in prison for it now makes us lead the world in putting people in prison. You know, here, I'm sorry to say that we're number one does not make me proud, but the United States leads the world in putting our people in prison, both by sheer numbers as well as per capita. And other countries look at us with horror. We've got to change our approach.
We're talking to Judge James Gray. Now, you write that drugs, because they're illegal, are paradoxically easier to get in schools than alcohol, and that if drug prohibition were ended, then it would be harder to get those drugs in school. However, I'm thinking, you know, there would still be a black market. I mean, I imagine there would still be a demand among teenagers, as there was when I was in high school and many years before.
Well, and that's right, of course. Anytime you're going to have some class be prohibited from getting this, there's going to be a black market to provide them. I understand that. And it's not a perfect world, and I certainly don't have the magic bullet for anything. But, Mary, if you go like I do and talk to high school kids or kids in junior college, young people under the age of 21, and just ask them the question, what is easier for you to get, marijuana or alcohol, or any other drug for that matter, or alcohol? The candid ones will tell you, two-thirds will even raise their hand saying, it's easier for you to get marijuana today. Why? Because the alcohol is regulated and controlled by the government, and the illegal marijuana or other drugs are controlled by illegal drug dealers, and they don't ask for ID. So, yes, drugs will still be available, and, you know, I was under 21 for 21 years of my life as well, and I knew that we could get alcohol. But it's harder now to get alcohol than the other drugs, so we can tighten the screws a bit. And if we do go to a regulated distribution, you undercut the price. You have to by maybe 50% to run the illegal dealers out of business. It's still illegal to buy, use, or possess any or sell any marijuana, for example, that's not sold in the government distribution facility, whatever that would be. So the criminal justice risk remains the same, but you undercut the price by half or so, and you start running the illegal dealers out of business. And then with Proposition 19 here in California, it actually strengthens the prosecutions against anybody that would furnish to a young adult, give it away, sell it, or otherwise. And I'm sure that society would support prosecutions of that kind, and the police would be able to refocus their attention on those sorts of offenses, as well as, of course, you know, the robbery, rape, murder, fraud, and all the other things that are really not being so strongly investigated and prosecuted today. we're spending so many of our criminal justice resources on nonviolent drug offenses.
One of the things that I think this points out is the massive inequality and lack of economic opportunity for the people at the lower end of the socioeconomic spectrum. And, you know, I would think that in a society, and you have, you know, many societies in Europe where any kid who grows up and goes to school and so on really does have a chance of making some kind of decent living, and there's a safety net and so on. We don't have that here. And I just find it so ironic that the people who are against any kind of government intervention in the economic life of our country are also against the legalization of drugs.
Well, it's a learning curve, Mary, and I was raised the same way probably you were and many of our listeners, to equate, for example, heroin with bad, with evil, with prison, and we're fighting decades of rhetoric that this is not something that people really put together too easily, and it certainly took a long time for me. But once you actually see what's happening, you see that drug money harms are even larger than the drug harms themselves. You see the problems with the dirty needles, which exacerbates the AIDS difficulty. With, you know, if somebody's going to make a stupid decision and get themselves hooked on cocaine, for example, why should you and I have to put bars on our windows to protect ourselves from them? I mean, that's a separate problem. We will learn, for example, that in Switzerland today, they have programs where heroin-addicted people can actually go to medical doctors and medical clinics. They show that they're addicted, and they can actually get heroin prescribed for them, which are filled in pharmaceutical prices, such that even the heaviest using heroin-addicted person can supply his or her drug for $10 a day maximum, so they don't have to go burglarize your house or your car in order to get the money or prostitute themselves, etc. And nobody is getting AIDS because they have clean needles, and the medical doctors work with them, and they can, most of them actually hold jobs, and they live pretty much normal lives. Good things start happening, or better said, fewer bad things start happening. Now, does that mean that we're condoning the use of heroin? Not at all. Does it mean that government or society condones the smoking of cigarettes just because it's no longer illegal for people over 18? Not at all. It's a serious problem. In fact, the biggest health risk of any of these drugs we can talk about comes from cigarettes. But we lose more than 1,000 people a day in our country that they themselves die because they themselves smoke cigarettes. Does that mean, because that's a major problem, which it is, we should make tobacco illegal? No, that just means that we'd bring Al Capone and Frank Nitti and people like that into the cigarette distribution business and only make things worse. So we're beginning to see it, and there's so much to talk about. You've mentioned my books. The other one, of course, is a voter's handbook, Effective Solutions to America's Problems. And if people do want further information, I have a website at judgejimgray.com. Gray is G-R-A-Y, so judgejimgray.com, and has a lot of further information there, too. It just takes a while to focus, to think, to ask questions, understand that just because we discuss these issues does not mean we condone drug abuse, but it does mean that we're trying to find a better way. And honestly, we couldn't do it worse if we tried, to the degree that, and this sounds like an exaggeration, but I'll stand on it. In fact, when I'm in Albuquerque and Santa Fe this Thursday and Friday, I'll mention it again. Drug prohibition is the largest failed social policy in the history of our country, second only to slavery. It has brought us more problems and caused more ruin to people's lives and their safety and their futures than anything we have ever done except slavery. It's time to repeal drug prohibition.
One thing that I think also gets lost in the conversation about drug use and drug abuse is precisely that distinction. Some people are drug users and are not drug abusers. What does that look like? In other words, people who are using, especially drugs like marijuana and even cocaine, how many of those people are problem users and how many aren't?
A maximum of 10% of those users of cocaine, for example, are problem users. It is estimated by the federal government, and usually statistics we use are the federal government statistics, that 20 million Americans are using marijuana on a regular basis. That means at least once a week. Of those, very, very few are problem users. I do agree that if you use when your body is developing, when you're younger, when you're under 21, that the chances of developing these problems is greater. I do support not allowing, by prohibition, young people from using this to get that word out. But mostly, of course, it's education that's going to do it instead of prohibition. But most people are not causing any more problems than I am as a user of alcohol. And honestly, I use alcohol pretty much every day. Now, if you were to substitute that mind-altering, sometimes addicting substance for any other one, most people would, including the criminal justice system, would call me an addict. You know, using every day, cocaine, whatever, you must be addicted. Well, I'm not addicted. I'm not a problem user. I don't beat up my spouse under the influence, or by the way, any other way. I'm careful not to drive a motor vehicle, etc. But that, again, Mary, gets us back to the distinction between holding an adult accountable for what he or she puts into her body, which the government has no business doing, as opposed to holding you accountable for your actions. That is what the government should control, so that if my driving under the influence, that now puts other people's safety at risk, that's a legitimate criminal justice function. But I'm a libertarian, honestly, and proud of it, that I think the government has as right, much right to control what I as an adult put into my body as they do what I put into my mind. It's just none of their business. Hold me accountable for my actions instead, and that's a legitimate function.
You've talked about the great expense to taxpayers of law enforcement, the criminal justice system, incarceration, foster care, the social costs of broken families, and so on. Talk about the comparative cost of drug treatment programs, drug courts, things like that.
Sounds like I wrote that question. Thank you. Rand Corporation came out with a study back in June of 1994. My goodness, what, 16 years ago. And they said that, hey, anybody care how your tax money is spent? Well, we can get 7 times more value for our tax dollar by drug treatment than by incarceration, even for heavy-using drug-addicted people. I mean, did you notice that? 7 times more value, even for heavy-using drug-addicted people. Where are the headlines? You know, this was in the Los Angeles Times, to my knowledge, on one occasion on page 10, and in the San Francisco Chronicle on one occasion on page 8. You'd think that we would have headlines saying, look, here's something that works. Let's go toward that. But honestly, there's no real sex appeal. There's no real political pull for treatment. There's a whole bunch for punitive stuff. And politicians, of course, are just deathly afraid of looking like, you know, they're soft on crime. If they mention, oh, let's put them in prison, that sounds tough. If they start talking about things that work, which are education and treatment, they kind of sound like a wimp, and politicians do not like to sound like wimps. So that's part of the problem. So if you look at it carefully, in any program you can put in or anyone else can, there are always some winners and some losers, right? Some people come out ahead, and you talk in education, healthcare, whatever you want. Some people come out ahead. Some people come out behind. Who is winning today with regard to the drug prohibition? And I have 6 groups that I'll try to go through quickly. The first group, obviously, are the big-time drug dealers. They're making hundreds of millions of dollars a year, tax-free. They're laughing at us. We already said that we only seize 5 to 10% of the illegal drugs. That's just the cost of doing business. They're coming out ahead. The second group of people that are winning are the juvenile gangs. And, of course, you have those problems in New Mexico, just like we do here in California and everywhere else around the country. The primary source of funding for juvenile gangs comes from the sale of illegal drugs, such that they actually use it as a recruiting tool, bringing more kids into this lifestyle so they, too, can be part of the action. Now, the third group of people, honestly, are those people in law enforcement that make huge monies from the taxpayers just to fight against the first two groups. And by the way, I am not pointing my finger at law enforcement. They're doing a good job. It's a dangerous job. They're getting more incarcerations and more convictions and more seizures than ever before. Problem is, we're still worse off than we were before, but they're winning. Now, the fourth group of people are the politicians who, in effect, get elected and reelected by talking tough with regard to the war on drugs. Not smart, just tough. It doesn't work, but they sure sound tough, and it keeps getting them elected. And, of course, that's our fault as the voters for letting them get away with that. Fifth group of people that are winning are those in the private sector that make money because of increased crime. Who is that? Well, people in the burglar alarm business or the security services. Obviously, the Prison Guards Union, which is the strongest political group, the lobby group in the state of California. I don't know about New Mexico, but I bet they're right up there in your state as well as every other. They are winning. And then the sixth group of people are winning
well, hang
are the
on,
terrorist
you just,
organizations.
Hang on one second. You didn't mention the private prison corporations.
Well, they make money because of increased crime. So, yes, anybody involved with the prison is going to be in favor of continuing with the status quo. That's obviously protecting their own economic self-interest. You know, people do that. And the terrorist organizations of the world have their primary source of funding from the sale of illegal drugs, to the degree that I call drug prohibition the golden goose of terrorism. And if we really wanted to beat back or strike a blow against the terrorists, take away their money. But, of course, we don't even talk about that. So who is winning? Those groups of people are winning. Who is losing? Pretty much everybody else, particularly including our children, which we've already talked about. They're being recruited to sell drugs for small amounts of money, and it's easier for them to get any drug today if they want to than it is alcohol because they're prohibited.
We're talking to Judge James Gray. Another group that you didn't talk about was people who are making and selling guns. There's this huge issue of guns flowing from the United States to Mexico and other Latin American countries.
It's a serious problem. And, of course, I was actually interviewed by a few newspapers in Mexico, and I told them they should legalize all drugs. They've decriminalized all drugs, but as far as the source of supply, it would not result in more drugs being available in our country. We already have as many as we could possibly use. So they should bring it under control, get rid of the drug cartels and all the money and everything else, because like you say, and it's a serious problem, those people are coming up selling drugs here and then taking a good part of that money and purchasing AK-47s and other guns and taking them down into Mexico. And those poor people, you know, they're just bleeding down there, as you know. And I was in El Paso not too long ago, right across the dry Rio Grande from Ciudad Juarez. And, oh, the killings that are going on, yes, of some drug dealers and drug cartel members, but also of police and innocent people and the rest. What is it? The number is 28,000 now in the last 2.5 years. Something just absolutely unconscionable. And it's caused, number one, by our drug money, not by drugs, but our drug money, and also, of course, by the guns that we sell them that they take down there, too. It's a serious, serious problem.
Let's talk about Proposition 19 in California. Californians are going to be faced with making a decision about whether or not to legalize marijuana very soon. What does the conversation look like right now in California?
Well, people are ahead of the politicians. There are not many politicians that I know of that are in favor of Prop 19, just like I can't think of any that were in favor of Proposition 215, the medical marijuana proposition back in 1996. But the people understand. And honestly, I've been in a room with 65 to 70 chiefs of police from around our country several times at Stanford University, the Hoover Institute. And once the doors were closed and the public microphones turned off, a lot of them spoke the same way I did, but they say, you know, we have a political job. We need political cover. I just can't tell the truth like you are because I have a political job and I'm responding to the mayor and the city council and the editorial boards of the newspapers. You know, I just can't tell the truth or I'd just be in political trouble. So the people need to give me that political cover. And at the moment, Proposition 19 is ahead, and I'm just asking your listeners to contact everybody knows someone that lives and votes in California. Please contact the people that you know and encourage them to vote in favor of Proposition 19 to regulate and control the sale of marijuana for adults and take it away from the juvenile gangs and the Mexican drug cartels and bring it back under the law. This is one of the most important elections of my lifetime, and we can really get down the road now a lot more to sanity than where we are at the moment.
I was just reading an article that said that some of the largest amounts of money going into the anti-Proposition 19 campaign are coming from alcohol sellers.
Well, I have seen that the beer industry has donated at least $10,000 to the No on 19 committee. And, of course, that makes perfect sense from a merchandising standpoint, that people act to protect their own economic self-interest. And, obviously, they don't want even increased competition from marijuana. I'd also mention to you that you've probably heard about that group called a Partnership for a Drug-Free America. Do you know who the original financial sponsors were of the Partnership for a Drug-Free America? It was the alcohol industry and the tobacco industry. I mean, drug-free indeed, but again, they were spending some rather substantial money to reinvigorate the distinction between licit drugs and illicit drugs, just like the beer industry has with regard to Prop 19. But the people are beginning to understand and see through that type of behavior.
What about the really horrible drugs? I mean, you can make a case for the relative lack of harm of marijuana and even the medical advantages of it, and even cocaine. One can make the case that a lot of people aren't going to get addicted in a harmful way and so on. But heroin and crystal meth and things like that, horrible, scary drugs that fry your brain and so on, and then hallucinogenic drugs, hallucinogenic mushrooms, LSD, and so on. How do you, in your view, should drugs like those be handled?
Well, Mary, these are serious issues, and I don't, any time pretty much when I'm in a debate or a discussion, I don't minimize them. And somebody says, you know, methamphetamines are scary, it scares me, you know, without question. But nonetheless, they are there. A part of the scary parts of these drugs is, again, the quality problems. A part of the scary problems is that we are making these people automatic criminals, pushing them away from the very healthcare professionals that can help them instead of bringing them closer to them for that help. So once again, you know, I would personally start, if I were king, and King James has kind of a precedent to it, but it hasn't caught on yet. But even back in 1992 when I held my press conference, I said that we should regulate and control strictly heroin, cocaine, and marijuana. Let's not touch methamphetamines yet, and hopefully people will gravitate over, if anything, toward the natural drugs instead of the synthetic ones. But I don't know. Let's start with marijuana. We'll all have more information. We can then look around and see if it should be expanded or contracted one way or the other and approach that. But again, it's, you know, and methamphetamines, I mean, they are scary. But wouldn't it be better if at least they knew what the strength is, at least they knew that the purity was there, that they didn't have battery acid in it or something like that, and that they were able to work closer with the medical professionals that can help them. And I kind of equate that to what I call the Rush Limbaugh issue. You know, seemingly he has a problem with pain in his back, a serious problem, and I take him at his word. And, of course, he had his kitchen helper or healthcare somebody dealing with folks out of trunks of cars. You know, let the medical community address those problems instead of making you associate with criminals and having all of the problems then that go with it, including, you know, why should they have to burglarize our house or car? I think I mentioned the problems that they're addressing in Switzerland with regard to heroin, that they're actually prescribing heroin for them. In the neighborhood surrounding the clinics, the merchants noticed a sevenfold decrease in shoplifting. I mean, they were very pleased. I mean, that's good. People don't have to shoplift anymore or prostitute themselves or burglarize your car or your house in order to get the money for these illegal drugs, which are always more expensive. You know, all of the drugs are dirt cheap. The only reason they're expensive is because they're illegal. So bring them closer to medical professionals and have the criminal justice system hold people accountable for their actions, which is what they're designed to do and what we should go back to doing.
Talk for a moment about the benefits of the hemp plant, both economically and environmentally, and even hemp that doesn't contain any usable concentration of THC, which is the active ingredient in the drug marijuana.
This baffles me completely, Mary. Why big-time agribusinesses have not seen and tried to exploit the whole hemp industry again, I do not understand. That today, hemp is a viable industrial crop. You can go back and look at old Ironsides, you know, the USS Constitution, and the sales were made from hemp, which is it's the stock of the marijuana plant. It has, like you say, no THC in it, no mind-altering properties whatsoever, very fibrous plant that you can make rope. Now, of course, I mean, I went to local markets. You can get hemp seed granola, which is very nutritious and healthy for you. You can make lacquer. You can do all kinds of things. We actually import hemp, a great deal of it, from those radical countries like Canada and England, for heaven's sake, where it's now not illegal to grow the hemp. They just treat it like cotton or anything else. And, of course, it's a $1 billion industry, so we're punishing our merchants and our farmers by not being able to raise it. Even the seeds, yes, they could have THC, but now they can be jerry-rigged, so they have virtually none. It has no effect on you whatsoever. And I'll leave this comment because it's enormously important. But the Western northwestern United States, so Washington, Oregon, we could revitalize the wood pulp industry there and revitalize that industry, because you can get four times the amount of paper pulp from an acre of hemp as you can an acre of trees. It takes 20 years to grow the trees and one season of 8 or 9 months to grow the hemp. And we can just revitalize that whole area and do ourselves a whole bunch of service. So I can't believe that, like, Philip Morris or Ligon Myers pharmaceutical companies, you know, Pfizer, hasn't gone into this and developed this as a big-time industry that it is, and it's only a question of time.
Another thing that you write about that I had never thought about was the environmental hazards of having a crop that could be environmentally very sound, but when you make it illegal, there are all sorts of environmental problems that happen.
Well, there are. You or I could go this weekend with a high school education in chemistry and go up into the hills someplace on a stream and manufacture methamphetamines and cook them, and then, of course, we're going to pour all the pollutants into the stream or whatever. There was a major forest fire just east of Santa Barbara in California a year and a half ago, and it was found that it was started by people, I think they were from Mexico, that were illegally growing marijuana, and the closest road was a mile away, and it's in a deeply secretive area. And so, you know, somebody had a stove, propane stove or something, and they tipped it over and caught the whole area on fire, turned into a huge forest fire. Now, you don't have Philip Morris, first of all, growing tobacco a mile away from the nearest road in dry countries because they don't have to. Now, that's a legal crop. You do if it's an illegal crop. And, by the way, if they start a fire, they don't run away because they know they're going to be responsible, so they try to put it out. That big fire was caused by drug prohibition. And, of course, then they found when they got there that they had all kinds of chemicals they were using, and they'd messed up the water reserve there, and they had all kinds of piping and stuff that they left there. It's just, but if you're growing marijuana illegally, environmental laws are the least of your concerns. So it's yet again just a part of this whole scenario that we couldn't do it worse if we tried, both for our environment, our safety, our prison population, our health, our children, illegal, the respect for the law, all of this sort of stuff. And to get on the high end, ask yourself, and I hope your listeners ask the same, how much corruption can you buy for $1 million in cash? And the answer is, at any level, quite a bit. And $1 million in cash is really nothing to a big-time drug dealer. And they are, in effect, corrupting border guards. They're corrupting children. They're corrupting... In my book, I cite numbers of people that used to work for Federal Express. I mean, who better to corrupt than those that have this transportation industry? And they had a whole bunch of people on their payroll. We have Mexican drug cartels now that literally have more money and more guns than the police. But in a lot of ways, it doesn't make any difference because the police are on their payroll anyway because of the money, not because of the drugs, because of the drug money. And those are the things that we really need to look at. And Prop 19 will be a big step forward in doing just that.
And still, we have a kind of combination of moralistic, idealistic sense that we can eradicate drugs, and going along with that, a kind of machismo that says that, you know, law enforcement and incarceration are the only way to deal with those things. And those are two long, long-standing parts of the kind of conservative ideology which you're really having to fight.
Yes, and it really crosses all political boundaries. I have been one person that I doubt there are any others that can make the following claim, that I have received basically a standing ovation from giving the same talk both to the ACLU on the one hand and the Young Republicans of Orange County on the other. You know, and it doesn't. People all realize what we're doing isn't working. And in fact, usually the first thing I ask, and probably when I'm with you in New Mexico, I'll do the same, how many people here feel that we in the United States are in better shape today than we were 5 years ago with regard to this critical issue of drug abuse and all the crime and misery that goes with it? And you look around and no hands are up. And if everybody pretty much realizes what we're doing isn't working, and then the first conclusion you draw from that understanding is, you know, Mary, we have no legitimate expectation of being in better shape next year than we're in today, unless we change our approach. So once again, let's put our heads together. Let's understand we can discuss this issue and come up with something that will be better, and we can't miss, because we couldn't do it any worse if we tried. We can only get better from here. That's, again, why I have my website out there for further information, thejudgejimgray.com. These are issues that we simply must discuss and work on together and make a lot fewer problems for ourselves and our children than we have now.
Judge James Gray is a retired trial court judge and former federal prosecutor in California. And he was a criminal defense attorney with the Navy. He's author of several books, including Why Our Drug Laws Have Failed, a judicial indictment of the war on drugs, and A Voter's Handbook, Effective Solutions to America's Problems. And once again, he will be speaking here in New Mexico, Thursday, September 30th from 6 to 7 at UNM Law School, room 2402, and in Santa Fe, Friday, October 1st from 5 to 6 at the Old Para Building in Apodaca Hall. And he's here sponsored by the New Mexico ACLU. Thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you, Mary. It's a pleasure to be with you. It's a serious issue. I hope I'm able to shake your hand when I'm there visiting good people. But I love New Mexico and looking forward to sharing good thoughts with good people. So thank you.
Thank you. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. My email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Thanks to Brian Highhill for engineering. Stay tuned for the BBC News, followed by local news by KSFR's news team, and after that, jazz.